Welcome to the Men of 8 Gang podcast, episode 353. I'm Steve Borsch, and I'm on with Tim Elliott.
Good morning.
And Phil Wilson.
I think we should have a goal. We should have a goal of 1,000 shows. What do you think? 1,000 shows.
Well, I'm thinking 10,000.
I'm not going to live that long, brother. I figure well, I've got 15 good years and that's it.
Hey, if we had a show every day, no, we'd have multiple shows a day. How about that?
That sounds like a good time, yeah. By the time we get to 9,000, we're going to be even more doddering old fools. So yeah. That's good.
All right, so let's touch on some top stories that happened in Minnesota this past week.
It's all about the kids.
Yeah. Well, talk about this first one. Young tech inventors find support amid skeptics.
Julio story this week.
Yeah.
Story.
Well, who's going to recap it?
Well, he runs down a number of tech entrepreneurs that happen to be in college or high school.
Yep.
And talks about Lightjot, which is a note-taking app, which I signed into, and it looks interesting, and a bunch of others, including this one that Carol Evan did a story on, too, the Mixers, which is a modular earphone deal that some high school students are doing here in town. Yeah, so it was a good call out to Mini Demo and talking about all of these young entrepreneurs. So that's good to see.
Yep.
And these guys, a lot of these guys are coming out of the U of M and the computer programming department, which is great to see. And I think there's always been great stuff that comes out of the U, has been since the dawn of the internet. So it's always good to see this continuing on. And Jake Larson is the guy that did Lightjot, and he was at Mini Demo. And they also talk a little bit about the guys that did My Bivy. What was the name of that? What was the name of that group? Because we talked about My Bivy, didn't we?
Did.
Yeah.
Yeah. So great stuff.
Yeah.
And it's I did check on this Mixer audio. It looks like the Kickstarter's struggling a bit.
Okay. So for those listening, we'll tell what it is. It's modular earbuds that allow for easy repair and customization. And
which is a great idea.
Yeah.
It is a great idea.
Well, I think, though, that there are so many earbud manufacturers and there's so many different price points that I think people pretty much just throw them away and buy new ones.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So
I think the key to this is going to be what's the quality of the actual bud itself? How good does it sound? And obviously I can't do that without trying it on because if you've got a really nice headset or earbuds, if you've got really nice earbuds, you don't really want to throw them away because they sound good. So
yeah.
If these are just run-of-the-mill earbuds that you can pick up for $15, probably won't be successful, but
they're $75. They're going to be $75 when they come out.
It's a little spendy.
They're Kickstartering them for $50.
Right.
So it's a good idea.
It's a great idea.
Have a tough road to hoe here on this.
Yeah.
But we'll keep an eye on them. Hope for the best.
Yeah, and it looks like. I'd like to see, just the actual buds have a contact.
It's good to see a non-med tech hardware play in town.
Yes, right, that's true.
Right.
Well said, Tim Elliott. Well said.
Yeah. Well, this there was also this company, Outsell, which offers auto sellers tools to help separate tire kickers from real buyers.
Which I couldn't really get an idea of how do they get this information. I didn't.
There's a lot of information out there. So this is a big data play. So if Graham were here, he would go wax on and on about how they've developed some sort of a algorithm to look at all this data that's publicly available, either through, subscription or elsewhere. Otherwise,
and do predictive marketing off of it.
Predictive, yeah. It does it kind of makes it, and then they give you tools to market to the individual as well. So it's a full service sort of a play.
And I think this is going to become more and more important as it dealers are going to be in a world of hurt when all these manufacturers around the world who have announced plans, all the car manufacturers, to have electric cars, that's going to put a serious crimp in the service revenue, which makes up the lion's share. Service revenue and used car sales make up the lion's share of dealers' revenues. And so there's got to be great concern there. So the better they get at identifying who's ready to buy a car, who's able to buy a car, and what kind of car they want to buy, I see these guys having quite a nice runway.
Yeah.
So good.
We're 100 employees now, and looking to add a few more. So it's, nice little business.
Right.
Check that out.
Right.
Outsell. You mentioned the gathering of data and predictive data, and Senator Franken, Al Franken, has asked for some more information from Clear Channel on the data collecting billboards they have in place, their radar program, which I got to admit, when I saw this, I was thinking, well, that was me, because I bit when I saw saw some of the billboards that they had up.
Phil, this totally went by me. I have no knowledge about this, but you being from the radio business,
I know
Clear Channel well.
It was just one of those billboards that was on the road, on the way to work. And it was like, well, that's interesting. I knew it was some sort of a cycling through media. You had to go from the billboard to the, I think the billboard that I saw referenced one of the morning shows on the Dave Ryan morning show on KDWB in some way that you would only know if you listened to the morning show. It was like talking about one of the hosts, and then it basically gave you a link to a website. So I brought that up on my mobile device, and it was this moving from one platform to another thing, and obviously collecting data as you went.
So. Yeah. Were you driving when you pulled up your mobile?
I stopped. Yes.
Okay. You pulled over. Stoplight. Flashes on. Okay.
I was on. No, I didn't.
Just
put the flashes on. I was at the stoplight.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So. He just called out to Siri.
That's exactly what I did.
Okay. I'm just checking.
Hey Siri, what's the deal on the billboard? No. I've never used Siri.
Oh my gosh. Seriously?
I've never used Siri.
Interesting. I dictate.
Old fashioned.
With my phone, I dictate text messages, or my phone or my watch. I dictate text messages and all of that. I've gotten pretty good at it. And
so what's the command to Siri to text message?
Well, it's not so much, you got to have the app open, but if somebody sends you a text message or on your phone, you can press the microphone and just dictate something.
That. Okay.
And then press.
I thought there was a Siri command you could use.
No. No, it's not very good at launching apps, or I haven't figured it out how to do it right.
Yeah. We can't ask Tim because he's using.
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope. I use Google now quite a bit but it's mainly for asking questions or for, getting phone numbers or something easy like that.
Yeah.
And it works almost every time, exactly the way you would expect.
So is anybody on the podcast upset that Senator Franken is asking for more information on the data collection?
No, I think it's good information.
Okay.
I hope that we learn some more about it.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see because, again, this tracking of data across multiple platforms is we're just on the edge of that. So it's going to be interesting to see. Yeah, as Outsell is using this tracking of behavior. Clear Channel is doing the same thing with various media that they're involved in.
Yeah.
Also this week,
this is a big deal.
I almost forgot about this, bringing this up this week, but our friends at NativeX, the Weber boys, have sold their company to, what is it, MobVista, which
is a
Chinese company.
And they're Asia's largest mobile advertising company.
So as I believe they're basically going to continue working here, running the company, right?
Yep.
Did I read that right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. And the thing is, though, is, this is just so funny because Graham and I had coffee the day before this announcement was made, and we were chatting about NativeX, and he goes, so do you know what's going on there? And I go, no, not really. And he goes, why'd Andy leave? And I said, I don't know. I think that it's gotten tougher and tougher as Google and Apple specifically, but also the whole in-app advertising space has changed dramatically, and also with what's been going on with the crackdown on third-party ad network companies that are delivering potential malware on occasion, that the whole thing is in such a state of flux that I think that it was strategically a great move to connect up with a company like this in China that's certainly got a much bigger reach.
Right.
And they can probably take advantage of NativeX's platform. So it seems like a good move.
Is it, $24.5 million deal?
Yeah.
All cash.
160 million renminbi.
Renminbi.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Just remember that.
Yeah, and of course, everybody thinks when there's an acquisition like this, great, the Weber brothers just split it in half.
Yeah. Yeah, right? That's exactly what happened, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
There's nobody else invested. Dude,
nah, not at all.
But congratulations to both Rob and Ryan. Good friends. As we say, good friends of the show. But,
that's right.
But really, it's great to see in their company in Sartell just outside the gates of their precious St. Cloud State. So,
I thought you were going to say just outside the gates of hell.
No. They've always been, they've never strayed too far from St. Cloud State. So they're proud alum.
They're great guys.
They are really great guys. Yeah. So what else is happening around the world?
Can I just
get an Apple FBI update?
Yeah, can I just give a quick one? I've had so many personal interactions with people who have emailed because of the podcast or posts or the editorial. I've been getting tweets like crazy.
Are you now hot on the speaking circuit?
Famous.
No, God, hardly. Really? But the whole Apple FBI issue has gained more clarity over time. And what's really fascinating is how the tech industry is lining up behind Apple in its war with the FBI. I'm going to put a couple of links in the show notes. And one of them is Apple's press info page that shows all the amicus briefs that have been filed. And you can look at the tech companies, Airbnb, Cloudflare, Kickstarter, LinkedIn, of course, all the ones, Amazon and Cisco and Google, Microsoft, Mozilla, yada, yada, yada. But you just look down here and it's like, whoa, Intel. It's a pretty amazing list of people who have signed up to file these briefs and be in support of Apple's position. So just wanted to give a quick update on that. Oh, by the way, just one other quick thing.
Very nice.
The U.S. Secretary of Defense came out this week on Apple Encryption and basically said, I'm not a believer in backdoors. And so now you have the former head of the CIA and NSA, right, Michael Hayden, coming out and saying, I don't agree with James Comey, the FBI director. And now you've got the U.S. Secretary of Defense coming out saying, hey, backdoors are a bad idea, basically.
What has happened to our political process and our government, our system. I mean, it's gone from, Donald Trump talking about the size of his penis to the former Secretary of Defense saying he doesn't believe in backdoors. What is happening here?
Well, I must admit, Phil,
come on, guys.
I do want to make an announcement that I am pulling out of the presidential race.
Pulling out,
effective today. Yes. So.
Oh, wow.
I won't
You're suspending
my campaign.
Okay.
And
see the sexual innuendo just goes.
That's right.
Well, that didn't really go all that well. But listen, before we have a serious conversation with our guest, Ash Dryden, coming up here in a little bit, there's a couple of other little more lighthearted things that I've found interesting. This piece that I think, Tim, you found at the McDonald's, now making Happy Meal boxes that turn into virtual reality headsets.
Yeah, they're doing it in Sweden, I want to say, or Norway, one of the two. Nordic country,
yes.
Sweden, yeah. The Happy Meal box actually turns into a Google Cardboard-like VR viewer that you stick your smartphone in.
Is that cool or not?
Really good idea.
That's a great idea.
Especially for kids, it doesn't really talk about the content here, no, but I imagine they would have some sort of branded content for the kids to watch. And it is sort of a high tech ViewMaster type experience, it's sort of 3D-y and it's immersive and this could go a long way. So I don't know if this is just the Swedish people in McDonald's doing stuff, or if they're just testing this maybe for a worldwide rollout someday.
Oh, I think it's got to be a test. I think
so too.
That's just a great idea. So, and what that content will be. Again, tracking that data, but moving you from.
They call it happy goggles.
Yeah.
Which has got to be funny in Swedish, whatever the happy goggles.
You're such a cynic. Okay. One last one, which is, I think, pretty interesting, is there's all these rumors about the iPhone 7 that'll have a better camera array in it. And Apple had purchased this Israeli company called Lynx Imaging for a reported $20 million that has multi-aperture cameras and stuff for mobile devices. And so it looks like they're going to have something pretty interesting for cameras in the iPhone 7. But now there's rumors that they're going to have an iPhone 7 Plus Pro iPhone. So I'm assuming that it may use that new Samsung 256 gig chip. So the storage will go way up. I mean, I'm just guessing, but then the camera in there, and maybe it'll have some other fancy schmancy little aspects to it. But that should be interesting.
I think if it's aimed at professional photographers, you know, it's not about the camera, but it's about pairing with their camera.
Right.
So using the phone as a viewfinder or some other kind of integration with their pro cameras. I'm sure it's not for pros to use the iPhone 7 as their camera.
No.
Well, I do think that in fact is part of it, but also when I think pro, I don't just think professional as in I make my living off photography, but I think of pro as prosumer.
Wow.
So people who are after better quality, and they're professional consumers, if you will, but they're still using it for consumer use. Maybe they use it for some business stuff and so forth, but they're not, you know, wedding photographers, or they're not, working for National Geographic or something. And anyway, so.
Well, listen, I a few weeks back we added to our list of events coming up the AlterConf, which is something new here. I hadn't seen before. AlterConf it provides safe opportunities for marginalized people and those who support them in the tech and gaming industries to learn from and encourage one another. It's very interesting to talking about things of diversity in the tech workspace, that sort of a thing. And the host for this, and I believe one of the founders of this, is Ash Dryden, and Ash is joining us as a guest. Should we get her on the phone?
Well, we should, but can I just say one more thing about her is that she received a White House fellowship for LGBTQ Tech and Innovation Fellowship. Mm-hmm. And she's a programmer, consultant, writer, speaker, and she's done some interviews and so forth, and we'll get her on and we'll have a chat about AlterConf and what she's up to.
Cool.
Is this Ash?
It is. Hello.
Well, hi, Ash. Ash. Steve Borsch, Phil Wilson, Tim Elliott.
I'm Phil.
Hi, everyone.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Good. So go ahead.
I was just going to say, how's the audio?
Sounds great.
It's fabulous.
Okay, good.
It's fabulous. So.
You must be in the tech business.
Yes.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. We just had a little bit about the intro to you and the AlterConf that's coming up on the 9th of April, which led us to you, which is a great springboard not only to talk about AlterConf, but to find out what you're up to and talk a little bit about the challenges you're helping to overcome in the tech industry. So, Ash, just tell us a little bit about yourself as far as what led you to...
Oh, you're breaking up, Phil.
Where you are now as it pertains to the AlterConf and some of the other things you're doing. Am I back now?
Yeah, yes, you're back now.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So I've been a programmer for 15 years. I spent the vast majority of my career being the only woman in the room. I organized conferences for 10 or 12 years and just generally noticed how bizarre it was to, one, be the only person in the room. I never have worked with another woman. I had never worked with any other marginalized people that I could tell. So it just felt really strange to be that one person. And then something happened in the Ruby community, a very public incident involving a speaker lineup for a conference. And I started speaking out about it. And then it just kind of snowballed into everything that I've been doing over the past 4 or 5 years.
And some scary stuff too.
Yes, a lot of scary stuff, unfortunately, yeah. Yeah.
Well, and what was amazing to me is, as Phil said that you were going to be joining us and so forth, I went out and just watched some of your talks and so on and looked at some interviews and that, and had no idea that you are looking to expand AlterConf into Africa, Australia, Asia, and Europe. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I started AlterConf because I wanted to move the diversity conversation beyond 101. I was speaking a lot at conferences, and there were a lot of other people speaking about these issues at conferences, but we were kind of stuck in this, what is diversity, why is it important, and like having to sell people on it. So it was very hard to move that conversation into a place that could be more in depth, that could talk about the breadth and the depth of diversity and inclusion and what we should be doing because it was artificially limited. So part of it was I wanted to create a space where people could talk about those things, but also knew that we have this really big issue where so many tech conferences are in San Francisco, yeah. New York, or Chicago, and not in very many other places, you know, maybe in London. But we don't really have many, you know, prestigious, you know, large conferences that are happening in many other places. So I wanted to bring the conversation to people. You know, it's much easier for us to move the conference on a mostly monthly basis to a different city than it is to ask, you know, 100, 200 people to fly in, to stay, and all that kind of thing in a brand new city they've never been to, and to get time off of work, find somebody to watch their kids, whatever it is. So it was much easier for us to move around. So we're basically bringing the stage to where people are, which is really important, especially when you're talking about diversity and inclusion. We want to meet people where they are. So by going to all these different places, we're hearing the different voices, the different perspectives, and the different issues that are facing people in communities outside of, you know, what we think of these big tech hubs like San Francisco, New York, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that, you know, and Phil's had some involvement with some groups about really working for coding for girls and getting women, you know, getting young women into the tech industry. And one of the things that you had said in this talk, this Monitorama talk in 2014, was that 56% of women in tech leave within 10 years. That just blew me away.
Yeah, it's a really scary statistic, and it's part of the reason I actually started doing this research, is that there are so many different programs that are focusing specifically on pipeline issues, right? So how do we get young people interested in tech, and how do we get them to, you know, pick it up in high school and university and that kind of thing and carry it through into a career? How do we give them that access, which is great. There are tons of people that are working on that kind of thing, and it definitely needs to be done. But the part that I'm focusing on is attrition. So people who are already in the industry or who are already in, you know, university for these kinds of programs, and they're leaving at an alarmingly high rate. So what do we do about that problem? Because we don't want to be bringing people into a really bad situation, which is kind of what we're seeing now. I mean, if we look at just the gender statistics for, you know, women going to university for, you know, computer science or a related field, there are there's a smaller percentage of them going into those degrees than we have leaving on a regular basis. So we are currently like losing this battle to for representation. So what do we do now in our companies, in our communities, in the industry as a whole to make it a hospitable place for them to live and to thrive and to give them opportunities? So that's the area that I focus on specifically.
I think that's really interesting. Just out of curiosity, Ash, do you know what's the attrition rate in the workplace overall for women as compared to technology? Obviously, I would assume that the technology piece is higher, but what is it like overall? How does it compare?
I honestly don't know. It's a statistic that I could certainly look up for you, but I personally don't know.
Okay, I was just kind of curious about that, but I think it's a very interesting piece of the puzzle to make sure that we're talking about not only getting more women into technology or more diversity into our tech culture, but also keeping them there, and that is a struggle, and until you sit down and talk to and try to understand what we consider, groups like, women and minorities actually go through in the workplace and actually hear the stories. It is very alarming as to what really that may not necessarily even be conscious. People are conscious of the surroundings or the environment they're creating. So I applaud you for that. That's great. But again, I think, you and I probably are on the same page that somewhere along the line, 70s, 80s in there, we screwed up and we stopped inspiring young women to get into technology. But we are in that situation where eventually, hopefully with all these efforts to get more and more women into tech earlier, that we'll be able to overcome and have more people coming in. So, until that time, Ash, what do you see are things that can be done right now to get more women into technology in a quicker, overcoming the education cycle or anything like that? Or is it just not possible to do?
So I want to take a step back first. So a lot of times when we talk about diversity, specifically in tech, we kind of use it as code for where are the women.
Yeah.
And diversity is so much more than that. And you can be marginalized in more than one way. So you can be a woman and a person of color and, a trans person and any other number of different things affecting you that change the way that that people approach you, the opportunities that they allow you to reach and that kind of thing. So I just want to expand that definition a little
bit. Well said, yeah.
As far as, what else we can do to bring more people in, this is something that I often debate with myself. I've read tons of research. I spent years doing research on this kind of thing and reading studies. And it's kind of a moral and ethical dilemma for me, right? Do I want to bring more people into an industry that is actively harmful, right? Like, we have huge issues around harassment, lack of opportunity, lack of advancement. We have people that are leaving in huge droves. And unfortunately, so much of the research is based purely on gender and purely on binary gender. So just looking at men versus women with no gray area in between there whatsoever, that we see so many people leaving for very specific reasons. And those kinds of things are not being addressed. So is it morally okay for us to want to bring more people into an environment where they're likely going to have left before they reach 10 years? So if you take a second and think about it, like, how long have you all been in the tech industry?
I've been in since 2008.
Me, my entire career.
And Tim has dozed off. Tim?
Yeah, no, I've been in one tech or the other for 30 years. So
okay. So if we consider the fact that based on that statistic alone, half of us will have had to have found another job. That means we're starting at the beginning, at the bottom of the ladder. We're basically going into entry level, maybe slightly above entry level in another industry, having to rebuild that network, rebuild those contacts, and rebuild that context for ourselves, potentially uprooting our families and our lives. That is a huge burden that we're putting on marginalized people. So that's, you know, that's why I want to focus so much more on what is happening right now, because I don't know that it is morally excusable to be trying to bring more people into an industry that is actively harming them and potentially setting back their careers, you know, their financial well-being and that kind of thing. So not that I'm trying to dismiss your question, but it's so much more complicated than just bringing people into the industry. So I really focus on what we can do in the here and the now to create an environment where they can succeed and thrive and where they belong.
I think that's a really good point. And I can see that. I guess probably my question should have been more phrased to what can we do to change the environment? I guess that's the one thing we look at. You know, will companies need to change policies? Will, you know, obviously those things have to happen. But I'm always on this quest of what can what can anybody do that maybe just a fellow employee or a manager at any given shop to make the environment more hospitable for those marginalized members of it. That's probably more the question than what do we do to get more people in the door?
Sure. And you know, that's a really great question. And there are a lot of different things that we can do. So starting with ourselves, the quickest thing we can do is to meet and listen to people who are not like us. Sociologically, we tend to know people that are like ourselves, the same race, the same gender, growing up in the same economic conditions. You know, think about like your neighborhood composition. We tend to know people that are very like us. And because we work in such a homogenous industry, that is even more true in other places. So if you're on Twitter, go and follow people who aren't like you. Listen to what they have to say. Don't feel like you have to jump in. But, you know, when something happens in the industry, consider the way that you react to it versus the way that they're reacting to it. Why is there a discrepancy there? What changes need to be made in the things that you understand and the context that you have going into that situation that make you feel the way that you do? So that's a huge first step in kind of self-educating around these kinds of issues. You know, do your research, read blog posts. AlterConf, which I run, has a very wide range of discussions around these topics. The videos are freely available on our website. Model View Culture is a really great place. It's an online magazine that talks about different issues around diversity and inclusion in the tech industry. And just, you know, read things that are slightly outside of your comfort zone so you can start to understand the issues around problems that are happening in our industry, because it's never like one simple thing that made all of these other things happen.
Well, can I throw in one thing real quick? Because it came out of that same talk that you gave at Monitorama in 2014, and it was the Petri multiplier from Ian Gent's blog.
Yeah.
And why an attack on sexism in tech is not an attack on men. And I know this is just sexism centric, but for those who want to kickstart their analytic side of their brain and look at some data, this is a great piece that really just shows how what most men would think was just throwaway remarks that maybe I'm doing with another man, right? And the kinds of things, or maybe I'll just throw away a remark that I think maybe is humorous, and it's not. And how many of these sorts of remarks happen. And so when you talk about a diverse community and you talk about people that are LGBT and the kinds of remarks that are happening and all that, that maybe this 5.6 remarks for women is, you know, 8.5 for people that are LGBT, for example. And so just because there's just not enough awareness, I don't think. I don't think people even think about what they're doing, men specifically. And, you know, this is spoken as one of three white heterosexual older males that are running this podcast, you know. And the one thing that I love about—
We're such a diverse group.
We are such a diverse group. But one of the things that I love that happens to me all the time in all kinds of different contexts when I'm around people that are quote unquote not anywhere not like me, that are LGBT or are women and are in tech, and it happens all the time, and this is what it is, and this is what I appreciate about it, is that I am always stopping and thinking, I would never have thought about that.
Right.
It's just this perspective that I wouldn't have even considered that. It's just like not on my radar screen at all because of, you know, who I am and how I grew up and where I came from and all those sorts of things. And so that's why having Phil say, hey, this is who we want to have on for the guest and all of that. And I started to look at all the things you'd done and watch some videos and all of that and really realizing the lack of awareness that I have with respect to diversity in tech overall. And it's sort of disconcerting and stunning. And so just this conversation alone has been great. And I just think about all the things that I come into contact with and run into and thinking, well, okay, so how can we help other people at least look in the mirror and say, you know, am I, you know, a contributor to putting people on the defensive and making them feel bad and making them leave tech within 10 years and yada, 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 especially when you said in that same talk, this problem of diversity can never be solved. And is that more about a statement about we're on a continuum and we're all going to have to grow together and it's going to constantly, you know, it'd be like racism, for example, it's never really gone.
I mean, it's a lot of different things. So if you haven't watched the talk, for the people who in the audience who haven't watched the talk, so I kind of compare the issue of homogeneity and lack of diversity and inclusion to a software project, right? You're working on the software project. People are, you know, telling you to put in new features and to make changes and, oh, there's a bug here and fix that. And you work on it and you work on it and it's been years. And you are still putting features in, you're still fixing bugs, people are still like telling you, oh, this is great, but you know, you could still do this to make it slightly better. So it's kind of like a software project that never launches, right? It never goes public. You just get fatigued from working on it constantly. And it's kind of the unfortunate part about these issues. So many of the root causes of what we're seeing now is culturally entrenched in the way we talk with each other, in the education that we have, in the representation, in what we see in media and who we see in media. All of these things kind of add up to create this, you know, perfect storm of an environment that makes it inhospitable for marginalized people to exist.
Yeah.
So there are tons of things that you can do to create a situation that is better, you know, where you're educating yourself, where you're doing your best to change the situation for other people. But even if you just consider the conversation that we've had today, you know, we've moved from diversity is not just women, to kind of our broader understanding of that. But our understanding of what marginalization is changes based on context, based on social and cultural norms, based on representation, all of those kinds of things. Because we have all of these beliefs inside of us, all of these biases inside of us, we do not realize that affect the way that we look at people, that the decisions that we make, that we have to always be learning something new. I mean, I've been doing this almost full time for 4 or 5 years, and I still mess up. I still learn new things all the time. Yeah. And that's the way that it should be. You know, you can't sum up all of human experience in, you know, a 1 hour talk or, you know, in a blog post. There's so much complexity there. And that's kind of the great thing about humanity, right? Like we should be striving towards having a culture where being different is fine. There's nothing wrong with being different, that we can celebrate those differences without also punishing people for those differences in other ways. So no, it's never done. And, you know, in all of human culture, we haven't seen this done yet. So I can't say that that will ever be 100% effective in anything that we do. But that doesn't mean that it's not worth doing.
No.
Talk a little bit, Ash, as we kind of need to wrap up here, but I do want to get a little more information. Could you tell us a little bit more about AlterConf here in Minneapolis? Maybe highlight a speaker or two, and then let's talk about the getting signed up and joining us there.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're unfamiliar, AlterConf is a traveling conference that is specifically focused on moving the diversity conversation in the tech and gaming industries, because they overlap so much, beyond a 101 level. So we talk about an incredibly wide range of things, from being young in the tech industry, gentrification due to, you know, huge amounts of tech money being brought in, being somebody who suffers from substance abuse and going to conferences where we overindulge in alcohol and that kind of thing, being a new parent in the tech industry, all different kinds of things. And we also go into different kinds of projects that people are working on that are helping to improve the situation, whether it's representation or a sense of belonging in the industry. So AlterConf Minneapolis happens on April 9th. It's a Saturday. It's just a 1-day, 5-hour event. You come, we feed you, you learn a bunch of stuff. Tickets are sliding scale from $0 to $100. So we try to make it as accessible as possible. We're still in the midst of announcing speakers. But we do have a few different speakers announced right now, talking about coming into the tech industry as a non-engineer, dealing with chronic illness in the workplace, and being somebody who is under 18 in the tech industry, or somebody who's under 18 and attempting to use online services that often have restrictions for people who are under the age of 13 years old.
Yeah, this really looks interesting. And how many speakers in total about will there be? Because you're talking to a lot of information in 5 hours. And boy, I mean, this really does look exciting. Do you have a hard time cramming it all into 5 hours?
Always. I feel like we could always use more time, but we wanted to make it as accessible to people. As far as the number of speakers, because we all of our speakers are marginalized people, first of all, and they're all speaking to their own experience, because many of them have never spoken at a conference before and they're nervous or they don't feel that their topic warrants very much time. Talks can be anywhere from 5 minutes to 25 minutes. We tend to have between 8 and 15 speakers, just depending on, you know, what the makeup of the talks are. And people talk about a really wide range of things, and you see so much more representation than you would at any other tech conference, which is awesome. But people are there hiring and recruiting and learning how they can be better within their companies, how they can change their own actions to be more welcoming and to offset the negative impact that has been placed onto marginalized people. Because even if we are not individually doing things that create this negative situation for marginalized people, we always benefit from it, right? So even if we are not personally discriminating against people as as white people, as we all happen to be, we still benefit from the fact that the industry hires majority white people, right? Gives us a much more likely chance that we're going to be hired over someone yeah. else. We'll be paid up to 50, 60% more than, you know, people of color. So all of those kinds of things, we can be offsetting and start to help, kind of turn the tide about things that are happening in the industry.
Well, and also I see that you have childcare available, meat, vegan, and gluten-free meals. You have gender-neutral restrooms, and so you've even set up the venue to be accommodating.
Yeah, so a big part of creating this space that centered marginalized people was to create an environment where they would have as much access as possible. So like you said, we offer free childcare. We have sliding scale tickets starting at $0. There's no hoops to jump through to get a free ticket. You just check out and get one. We automatically offer sign language interpreting and live captioning. We have inclusive meals. If people have religious restrictions, we'll go to vendors that specifically focus on kosher or halal or whatever it is, and we'll make sure that a meal is prepared specifically for them. Mm-hmm. We are always at ADA accessible venues on public transit lines. We serve a healthy meal, so people are, you know, getting that out of it as well. But we try to create this environment that is as neutral as possible, because there's so many things when you're in the tech industry that make you feel slightly othered. You know, oh, I have to leave early because my kid is sick, or the conference insurance doesn't cover babies being here. So even though I'm a new nursing parent, I can't bring my baby, which means I can't go, or I know I'm not going to be able to eat, or I'm fasting, or I can't be around alcohol, which we do not serve any alcohol. All of these things kind of create a situation for marginalized people that makes it slightly harder to participate and feel like they can be there as their whole selves. So we try to create as neutral of an environment as possible to let them know that it's important to do, that they're worth doing it for. And we want to show other tech conferences that there is no excuse for not doing those things. Our events, our budget is between $8,000 and $12,000. And we do all of those things without an added expense. Plus, we pay our speakers, who are all marginalized people. We pay freelancers local to the area. We're highly involved in local communities, and we hold a conference almost every single month in a different city around the world. So it can be done. It's not impossible. You just have to make it a priority.
Yeah. Outstanding.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say one last thing. You did mention in an interview that you've got a few more surprises in the works for mid to late 2016. Anything you want to leak?
Not yet.
Okay. All right.
I'm still working on it. But there's also another awesome project that I'm working on with Shanley Kane of Model View Culture, which is called Fund Club, F-U-N-D Club, where you can give $100 a month to a different project or organization that's furthering diversity in tech. All of the money goes directly to the organization. We do not touch anything. We don't act as middlemen. But it's kind of like a charity of the month club. So once a month, you get an email from us saying, here is our pick, you go and give them money. And we've raised almost $100,000 since last July, I think.
Over 72,000 raised total, I see.
Exactly. So we've made a huge impact, and we're targeting specifically people who make, you know, $80,000, $100,000+ a year. There's no reason to not be giving back. And this is a great way, very passive, very simple, for you to make an impact in the lives of marginalized people in the industry.
Very cool. Very great. Cool. Well, AlterConf is coming up on the 9th of April. Tickets are now available. Go to alterconf.com. Ash, we look forward to seeing you there.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This was a lot of fun, and I look forward to meeting you all there.
Thanks.
Sounds great.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Yeah, have a good one. Bye.
Bye-bye. So now it's time for the cool thing of the week.
Yeah.
And so Phil, I'd like you to start, buddy boy.
Because I'm topical as all get out, and this appeals to my cheap side. You know my experience with the Amazon Echo.
Yes.
And how I purchased it and didn't use it as much as I'd like and didn't feel it was connected enough to all of my smart home stuff. And of course, it became connected right after I sent it back. But now Amazon has a low-cost version of Echo. It's called the Echo Dot. It basically does everything that the Echo does, except it doesn't have the quality speaker system in it that the Echo does. The Echo right now does allow for using it as a Bluetooth speaker, and it actually sounds very good. But Echo Dot does away with that, makes it smaller, and wonderfully makes it a little less expensive.
And it'll work with smart things.
And it works with smart
Philips
things.
Hue and stuff, yeah.
Yep.
And so can I ask you a question?
That's only $89.99 rather than the $170.
Yeah, that's throwaway money for a guy like you.
Yeah,
okay.
That's right.
So question about this.
Yes.
Since Amazon announced that they were no longer going to encrypt Fire OS that runs their TV stick and the laptop, you know, and so forth, or the tablet and so forth. Are you worried? And now they did an about face and said they're going to encrypt this Spring. But do you worry about this being on all the time and potentially?
I'm always concerned about that. Okay. And I think that Amazon has commented on that by saying it's highly encrypted and you know there's a lot of security involved. But still, you say. It's always on. It's always listening.
Right.
Yes, granted, it doesn't come to life until you say a specific word, Alexa, but it's always listening. So, you think about that all the time. So also, just as a side note, at the same announcement of the Echo Dot, which, by the way, you can only get if you have an Amazon Echo right now. There's a limited quantity, so they're only selling them to existing Echo subscriber or Echo owners. Because they see this as an add-on, you can put Echo in more rooms. But they also announced the Amazon Tap, which is basically a Bluetooth speaker with Echo built into it, right?
Oh.
So
it's more of a traveling one, though.
Yeah.
So not as good as the original Echo. And it's $130, so it's – I don't know. If it's between that and the standard Echo, I might upgrade to the standard one.
I would.
This one, you actually have to push a button to invoke it. It doesn't just listen. You actually push a button, you say what you want, and then it will deliver the response.
Cool.
Interesting.
That's why they call it the Tap.
So, I did see that there were a couple of posts about you could actually order the Echo Dot without having the Amazon Echo. There was a flaw in their mobile app that you could actually purchase it by swiping right. I've found that those have been closed. Those little problems,
bummer,
opportunities have been.
Well, you'll have to wait.
Shut down. Wait. Yeah, which I'm in no big hurry, so that's all good. So, Tim, what do you got?
What's yours, buddy?
Well, Raspberry Pi 3 came out this week, and as the 2, which I don't know, it's been out for a couple of years now, it's basically a speed bump of the Raspberry Pi 2. But more importantly, they've included on the board Wi-Fi and Bluetooth.
Which so you don't have to add them.
Yeah, because that just provided a lot more complexity for normal people. For hobbyists, it's not a big deal to get dongles and hook them up, and you know, most of them worked right out of the box without installing new software. But sometimes you had to do some software stuff to get it to work. So now, still $35. And more importantly, with the speed bump, it's probably fast enough for most people to use as a regular computer.
Wow.
In the past, Raspberry Pis have been slow and noticeably slow if you use them in desktop mode to browse the web and do email and stuff. And in my mind, unusable for that purpose. But there's plenty of other things you can do with them. This now makes an interesting entry into basically a $35 computer that's probably okay for most people. So, you know.
Its memory is only a gig.
Right, yeah.
I mean, so what are you going to run some stripped down Linux in there?
Yeah, that's what it runs.
Yeah.
It runs a version of Debian, and it's full-featured. It has everything available. But anyway, what I would use it for, though, to follow to Phil's deal, is you can actually build your own Amazon Echo from a Raspberry Pi. Similar to the Tap, you have to push a button to invoke it, but, you know, for $35 plus a little bit of time to get an Echo going – and hook up to an existing speaker, you know, I may actually do something like that.
That's kind of cool. I got to tell you, I may do that. So what the heck?
Very interesting.
I love it.
DIY.
I love the DIY world.
Huh.
Steve?
Well, mine is one that I think somebody did a cool thing of the week a while back, but I'd never actually seen one in operation.
Right.
I saw one this past week. It's called the Automatic. And there's a port in every car since, I think, 1995 that allows all kinds of diagnostics, you know, so when you roll it in, you take it into a dealer, they can hook up their computer to it and do diagnostics on your car. Well, the automatic adapter plugs into that same port, and there's an app for your smartphone. You can do stuff like decode your engine problems and have it notify you if your gas is low, or it can find your parked car and all kinds of other stuff, get human help in an emergency. So, I mean, it's a pretty cool thing, especially since there's an Apple Watch app as well. And I looked at this, and anyway, so I was with a guy this week who had one in his car, and it's a 2-year-old car, and he goes, you know, for the most part, I'm probably not going to really need this for another couple of years. But he said, I liked it so much, I bought one for my kids, for each one of their cars, because they're driving older cars. And I thought, that's fascinating, because that's exactly what my kids need, is something that'll alert them that, hey, stupid, get your oil changed, or, you know, whatever. It won't say, hey, wash the car, but...
What's really nice about these types of things is that if you get one of those check engine lights where you go into your mechanic and they charge you $100 just to read the darn thing.
Right.
Yeah.
This gives you an interface into what that is.
And there's a web dashboard too.
Yep.
So you can really dig into what some of the problems are.
This do not disturb piece is really cool, but it's only on the Android version. But basically automatic will put your phone into do not disturb mode when you're driving. I think that's brilliant.
And it's only $99.95.
Yep.
So,
but if you don't want to spend that much, you can find these adapters, the cheap generic adapters on eBay and Amazon for under $10. And I use the Torque app, which is an Android app, which I think it's $3 or something like that, which reads it via Bluetooth. And for $15, let's say, you can have something like this. Now, not as elegant as automatic. I think their software is beautiful. But if you want to DIY it, you can do that. And that's what I use. And I use it primarily to look at engine lights when they come up. Our car's getting up to 9-10 years old now.
Yeah.
So those lights come on, and I know what some of the problems are. And if it's the same problem I've had in the past, which is, you know, something that's not critical, then it saves me the $100 to go,
right,
you know, and have someone tell me that information. So
awesome.
It's interesting.
It's a good thing.
It is a very good thing. Nice.
Indeed.
All right. That's it. That's probably one of the best cool things of the week we've had.
All right.
That goes into my winter
event.
That's
a cool thing of the year.
That's a cool thing of the year. That's the best of right there.
There we go.
Well, and we talked about all these upcoming events.
Yep.
And we'll just mention again, because of our guests, that AlterConf is April 9th at Lead Pages.
Yeah.
And we'll have links in the upcoming events area on the podcast. And we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next week on
the Minivate Gang Podcast.
All right. Take care.
Have a good week. And I'm still standing on the hill at the rooftop 309. 309 rooftop, but things getting worse. A stone brain and an empty purse. Come on, help me release my pain. Let me just be a renegade. Hey.
Let the blues up 309. Bom, 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 ba-dum, ba-dum.